we have to shift our mindset to be thinking of what are those little things that made that experience exceptional in another industry, in another part of life, and how do we bring that back to healthcare, and particularly for serious illness, where individuals are so lost, they're faced with such difficult decisions, really the most challenging part of life. And that's the time when our customer service has to be exceptional every time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Health Technology Podcast. My name is Christine Minotto, and I'm the director of the UCSF Rosamond Institute at the University of California, San Francisco. Our guest today is Ryan Van Wert. Ryan is the CEO and founder of Thinka, a company that is addressing an unmet need in healthcare during end of life. At this most difficult time, the care a patient receives is not often what they would have wished. Quantity often wins out over quality. The reasons for the disconnect are many, including incentive for providers, poor communication, and recording of preferences. Ryan identified the need to improve end-of-life care during his time in Stanford. As a practicing clinician, he finds that being immersed in practice gave him valuable information about the many changing needs of patients, caregivers, doctors, and other stakeholders. This helps him inform his business decision. You will learn from this podcast how Ryan and Thinka think about disrupting the business of end-of-life care with the goal of providing better customer service. And if you like what you hear today, please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. And one more thing, are you a founder of a health technology startup looking for an industry partner or seeking funding from seed to Series A? Apply to the 2020 Rosamond Innovators by Tuesday, April 14. Applications are open on February 18, and details on our website at rosamondinstitute.org. Well, thank you for joining me today here at UCSF Mission Bay campus. I thought it would be good to start in terms of, you have a really interesting background. You're a clinician, become a CEO of a startup, but you know, maybe you can tell us a bit of your background, how you become where you are today.
Yeah, absolutely. And first of all, thank you so much for having me on today. It's a real honor. And my background is I started off as a chemical engineer and worked in product development very briefly for GlaxoSmithKline, but shortly thereafter decided that I really wanted to go to medical school and pursue that career. Most of that education was in Canada, and completed my residency up there and then came down to Stanford with a goal of completing specialty training, but also understanding that this is really a hub of health technology to finally bring my engineering background back into a career in medicine. And didn't know what that was going to be like. Came down with a pretty open mind, thinking perhaps of going into artificial organ development, but quickly realized that was going to take me down a basic science path, which really, really wasn't for me, and was fortunate to come across the program in biodesign at Stanford and found that very appealing in the sense that it was very much focused on, first of all, need and value-driven healthcare innovation. But secondarily, even though medical technology is a multi-year process, it still is a process in which there are very tangible next steps to bringing a technology to impact patients. And that was really what appealed to me about moving into the health technology domain and completing that postdoc. So that really was, for me, a fundamental change in career. I had come down thinking that I would be largely a clinician. I didn't really know how this engineering would fit back into a career, and just feel very fortunate that I was able to have that experience.
So you were a clinician at the same time you're at the biodesign. How does that work?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the program is actually relatively flexible that you're able to meet your requirements for fellowship during the program. So for me, that meant doing a half-day longitudinal clinic and a few months of intensive care training. My specialty was pulmonary and critical care medicine. But the remainder of the 10 months of that year was spent doing the biodesign program.
And I also noticed that even before you did the biodesign, or maybe that's during your biodesign, you also created a company that was licensed out to Cook Technology. And so you kind of have that little bit on your belt. So it's not like you're a completely newbie in this space. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, there were two projects that came out of the biodesign program. Both of them had ultimately to do with intensive care medicine. And as with the biodesign mantra, had to do with very important clinical needs. So the first was related to intravenous sedation in the intensive care unit, which are the drugs that put people into so-called drug-induced comas. But unfortunately, they're associated with many of the hospital-acquired complications that occur in intensive care patients: ventilator-associated pneumonia, prolonged time on ventilators, prolonged recovery and rehabilitation, blood clots, et cetera, resulting in billions of dollars. And all because we're using these medications to keep people comfortable. And our insight in biodesign was that one of the main drivers of this was the fact that people who are on ventilators are fundamentally uncomfortable because they have a large tube that's going down into their airway. And recognized that there was some research going back into the 80s and 90s where anesthesiologists had numbed that part of the airway, and they had been able to achieve marked reductions in the need for sedation, but it really wasn't done in a way that fit into the clinical workflow of the ICU. So we developed a catheter that effectively allowed for that local anesthetic effect to be applied, thereby reducing the need for intravenous sedative. And that we funded with some internal grants within the university, some external grants, and got it to a point where it was a good fit to license out to Cook Medical. The second project was what I spend most of my time on now, which is really related to how we deliver end-of-life care in this country, and a recognition that when people are faced with a serious illness, they often have not had meaningful conversations, codify those conversations in a easy to access way that allows clinicians to direct the care they want. And unfortunately, our healthcare system is set up that we are singularly focused on prolonging life. We're singularly focused on delivering care that is curative when possible. But the fact of the matter is that as people are faced with serious illnesses, more often than not, their preference is to avoid these aggressive interventions and focus instead on quality of life. But unless you have a means of changing that paradigm, i.e. through an individual expressing their wishes in advance, the default will occur. Mm-hmm. So we were seeing time and again people coming through the doors of the emergency room who either hadn't had a conversation about their care preferences, or they'd had a conversation and the document was in a safe deposit box or left at home. And of course, then we do as physicians what we're trained to do, which is to sustain and prolong life, and recognize the toll that this was taking not only on the individual who ultimately had their care preferences not honored at a very important time of life, very traumatic for the family, extremely problematic from a clinician perspective, and I think really feeds into a lot of the talk around physician burnout, particularly in critical care, when we know that we're likely not providing care in a way that is consistent with an individual's wishes. Mm-hmm. And then meanwhile, this is one of the most costly segments of healthcare delivery today. I think most people are familiar with the statistics of about a third of the Medicare budget being allocated to the last year of life. You can argue a lot of that is appropriate care for things like surgeries, chemotherapies, advanced treatments for heart failure or lung disease. But when you look at the last few months of life, we're still seeing about $60 billion of spending. And in that particular case, the insight is that, you know, a lot of that is really not care that is addressing the goals of that individual. Mm-hmm. So we saw an opportunity to leverage technology to support the process of helping individuals to go through this process of making these difficult decisions, making sure that those wishes are memorialized, and then ensuring universal accessibility throughout the healthcare system, and brought both of those projects out simultaneously and around the time that the first technology was licensed to Cook. We were seeing some interest from Silicon Valley angel investors that saw, I think, the need from a social good perspective, but also saw the opportunity of a business that could be created around that, just given the magnitude of the problem. And we're able to close a seed round and then a Series A, and we're off to the races after that.
Yeah, so for some of the listener, maybe go over with us, like, so if I'm a patient, and how do I interact with you guys? Because, you know, I'd like to make sure when I go to hospital, they treat me the way I want to be treated.
Yeah, absolutely. So our primary customers are healthcare organizations. So all of the interaction occurs through technology that we are more often than not integrating into their systems. We have a variety of tools that help clinicians to have this conversation and document it accurately, and a variety of tools that the individual patient, as much as I don't like that word, the individual can access to go through the process on their own. A lot of this is very highly personal, and people want to go through the process of reflecting on their values by themselves or with family members. And the technology allows for that interaction through some direct web accessible tools that the individual can use as well. And then we are aggregating all that information in a single spot. So if someone, an individual has it goes through a process, creates an advanced directive document, if a clinician creates a medical order related to goals of care, or if that's done, for example, in a skilled nursing facility or a neighboring clinic, we are aggregating all that information in a single spot so that when it's needed, the clinician can get the most up-to-date information to provide care for that individual.
Okay.
And that we achieve through an EHR integration strategy where we're able to deliver this information to the point of care where it's needed to direct care.
I'm going to ask you, maybe this is going to the weed, like a lot of different care facilities have their own database system or computer system. How do you aggregate them? How do you make sure they all play along nicely so that they can bring all the data to your cloud data?
Well, on the cloud side, we were fortunate to have some really great machine learning engineers on the team who developed a patient matching algorithm that was able to manage the data coming in from these disparate sources. And that was actually awarded by the ONC in 2017. The top prize in a patient matching challenge ahead of 140 other academic and vendor entrants. In terms of receiving the data, we've taken, I would say, a large bite out of the apple approach, where we've developed integrations with the large EHR vendors, and that takes, call it 70% of the market or even 80% of the market these days. And then for the long tail that exists within healthcare technology, as you're alluding to, we will typically use standard single sign-on methodologies that allow us to tie into the majority of systems. And then we have just basic web portal and other ways that individuals that maybe don't have the means or ability to do a formal integration, that they can still access the system.
Okay, so I assume when, as a patient going to the provider, they probably can have this conversation when they're healthy, like doing their regular physical exam And then also maybe when they got inpatient treatment, is that an option? Or is that like a part of the flow that they're changing now as part of the conversation they have with their patient?
Absolutely. And I think when we think about it, everyone over the age of 18 should really have some form of advanced care planning. And when folks are young and healthy, that often is just identifying a substitute decision maker who can speak for that individual if there were to be an accident or whatever the case may be. As individuals advance in age and perhaps develop multiple chronic conditions, it's an appropriate moment to perhaps reflect on values and consider what is really important in life. And then as serious illness develops, which is life-limiting, that's when those values need to be translated to goals for care. And those are often the goals that we overlook in medicine. They're the things that really matter to you and I in life. Mm-hmm. But the treatment decisions that are made impact those in an incredible way. And in the case of serious illness and goals of care discussions, that's when the treatment options need to be weighed against the real values and what's important to that individual. Mm-hmm. And so I guess to summarize, there is a different form of what we call advanced care planning that applies to every individual through life stage disease process. Mm-hmm. And our goal is to enable that process across an entire population.
So in terms of your product offering, you provide that kind of a management of managing your care directive. I assume the hospital, the provider still manage about the treatment option that they're going to have with the patient. Is that something that you also provide, or that's kind of being left for the hospitals?
Our goal is to provide the clinician with as much information as possible about that person's goals and values so that they can support shared decision-making to achieve exactly that.
Okay. So in this case, I mean, there's an incentive for the hospital to participate in this program, but I assume there's also interest from the payer side. And do you interact with them? How where are you in that, if you don't mind telling?
I think the reality of our world today is that every healthcare provider organization is in some way or another bearing risk, i.e. in the traditional fee-for-service world, there was an incentive to do more. And now, thankfully, the focus is shifting to risk in a way that recognizes quality. And that, particularly around the end of life, is exceptionally important. So our focus to date has largely been on health systems because of those value drivers, but we have increasingly had interest from health plans who feel that it's important for their members to have access to tools to support this kind of decision making. So as a company, we are shifting from our health system focus, which is still a major focus, to looking at the needs of health plans as they address the quality of care at the end of life for their members.
This podcast is sponsored by Ron Ratnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that helps life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownratnick.com. So if as an individual, if I'm interested to be included in your database, because I'm always worried if somebody's going to resuscitate me when I don't want to be, how do I get into the system?
Well, right now, the means of an individual accessing the system is through a partner healthcare organization. We have thought a lot about direct-to-consumer models, but in terms of how we've thought about our market strategy, we have made this more of a B2B2C at this point. So it would be a matter of being a patient or a member at one of our clients that you could access the system.
Okay, and can you tell us which system that you're in right now?
We've got a great, we're really fortunate to have a really great customer base. Locally in the Bay Area, Sutter Health is a client of ours. And we have a large concentration of hospitals in Oregon and Washington State, where many of the fundamental frameworks around documenting care preferences were developed over the last few decades. Overall, we have a presence in 10 states now, Intermountain Healthcare, Highmark Allegheny, Presbyterian Health Services in New Mexico, and several others.
That's great. You have a lot of options. So maybe we can change gear a little bit. You've done really well, you know, raising the money. Prior life, are you still a practicing clinician or?
I do one day a week of clinic, yes.
One day a week, that's a lot. What are the things your training or being a practicing clinician that, you know, we all have certain mindset or habits that, you know, that translatable, and there's some part that need to be like being left behind the door. What are the areas that you benefit from your training, and then the area that you just like, those are something that I should not bring in when I'm a CEO of a company?
It's, you know, I have to say, I think most of the, what I do on clinical days, you know, I still really enjoy the patient interaction. And now I'm fortunate to have people that I've known for many years and been very privileged to care for. And I have to say, I think most of the learnings from the clinical environment really directly relate to the business. And that, I think, first and foremost, the recognition that any healthcare technology is never going to work or have an impact if it's not truly addressing the multifaceted users within the healthcare system. And there's no better way to understand the needs of those users, the reality of clinical workflows, the reality of what it takes to drive adoption, than to be living that every day. And I think that's probably the most important thing that the clinical practice brings back to Vinca as a company. Mm-hmm. There are other things that I would say in our world, so much is changing day to day, from reimbursement, incentives, policy, that I have had insights on only because I've been subject to that in one way or another as a provider. That as much as we try to keep up to speed on that as a business, we still there's still always so much happening that we. That having more sources is always better than fewer. So I think in general, I have to say, just about all of what I learn and experience on the clinical side, I think delivers value back to the business.
Yeah. And I was talking to somebody the other day. He's a clinician and also now moving away from the clinical hat. One thing that he mentioned about when you're a clinician, everybody is waiting for you to tell them what to do. And when you run a company, you need to know how to delegate because you cannot do it all. And is that the case for you or?
That's very true. And I think there are analogies around building a clinical structure around having nurses, medical assistants, otherwise, and doing a better job of delegation that I think learning from the role at Vinca, I've been able to get more efficient at on the clinical side. The other really important point I think you're bringing up, though, is that we as clinicians traditionally in the traditional healthcare paradigm have really are really used to having patients wait for us. You know, and it's okay if we're running 20 minutes late. You know, it's okay if we don't, you know, call back in a few days. That's all okay. And what other industry is it acceptable to have that level of customer service, right? And so I think that as I think about Vinca, we have very different expectations in terms of our clients, in terms of our users, than even today traditional healthcare is delivering to individuals. And that to me is one of the going to be drive the biggest disruption, I think, in healthcare in the coming few years. We see many models now that are happening outside of the traditional integrated delivery system, the One Medicals of the world, other more primary care focused practices that address Medicare populations, where you can go onto an app, you can have a video visit, and everything is seamless. And you walk into a bright clinical waiting room, you're welcomed. And that's the experience that we expect in every other industry. And
except healthcare and DMV.
Exactly. And that's going to change because there are forces in the market now that are driving in this what is called broadly the consumerization of healthcare. What it really is that individuals have choices now, and those choices are going to drive how fundamentally money flows within the traditional healthcare system and really make, I think, tectonic shifts in how healthcare is delivered. So for me, as the CEO of Vinca, we have to be thinking about how is our experience seamless for the individual, the end user, whether that's the quote-unquote patient or the clinician or otherwise. How are we delivering exceptional service and exceptional product, exceptional support to our clients? And that is really our focus and goal is to constantly delight our end user, because that's the only way we survive at the end of the day as a company.
I'm glad you think that way. Ease of use. We just like to push a few buttons and we get there.
Ease of use.
Yeah.
You know, I think I was at a conference a few weeks ago and one comment that struck me was around these little things in other industries that really make the difference in customer service. And I think as clinicians, as anyone that's involved in delivering healthcare, whether that's as a vendor or a clinician or otherwise, we have to shift our mindset to be thinking of what are those little things that made that experience exceptional,
right,
in another industry, in another part of life, and how do we bring that back to healthcare, and particularly for serious illness, where individuals are so lost, they're faced with such difficult decisions, a really the most challenging part of life, and that's the time when our customer service has to be exceptional every time.
I'm glad to hear that, because I think as you get older, when you're so sick, you're all drugged up, when you're confused all the time, and having somebody who's there to provide trusted services, that's very comforting for a patient to go. Do you think that seems like a change of culture, though? And you always seems need to start from medical school almost. And how do you change that?
It's a great question. I think that a lot of, and I think this has improved and is getting a lot more attention. First of all, the selection of medical school candidates to be, to include more than what we think of, or what we might have thought of a few decades ago as to what makes a good doctor, being strong in science and math and such. I think that has changed in terms of looking more holistically at candidates. Certainly, there has been an increased focus on communication skills and otherwise. Could there be a lot more around particularly serious illness conversations, general empathy training? Big gap still.
Nice.
And I think there is an increasing recognition of that, and hopefully that'll translate more into curricular changes. But ultimately what's going to change behavior is an incentive or a penalty. And we see that now in the patient satisfaction scores as I think the first very crude iteration of that. But what's really going to change behavior is going to be an economic driver that will ultimately change that drive, change of that experience, and change of that culture.
Yeah, no, that's it's. I mean, I feel like with the technology, the marketplace, things are changing so much faster now, and everybody is too small not to embrace it to set that path, I think. So, last question before we break. What are the things that you read right now? Or you don't have time to read because you start reading all your medical journal and work stuff because you're on top of running a company. You work one day a week. That's a lot.
Most of my reading is related to the company, I would say, and keeping up on my area of specialty. Although a lot of my background as a physician, of course, did not include a lot of business training, and I've been forced, thankfully, and I really actually enjoy that part of the job, is learning more about the mechanics of a business. So a lot of what I read is around management, leadership, building great companies, those kinds of books. And I do have a desire to read more fiction, but most of my spare time is on filling out the where I need to continue to learn around the phase that we're at in the company, which is moving from a phase of having some great early clients to now growing and scaling the business.
Yeah, no, that's great. Well, thank you. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening today. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.